The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome to the Eric Metaxas Show. It's the show you've all been waiting for. Until now. Until literally right now.
Now!
Literally right now. Literally. Now your host, Eric Metaxas.
Hey there, folks. This is the Eric Metaxas Show. This is the show where I get to talk about whatever I want with whomever I want. Actually, not with whomever I want, because there are a lot of people deceased. There's no way they're coming on the program. There are a lot of people that just don't want to come on the program. We can't reach them. But every now and again, I get to connect with somebody that I want to speak with. And that's the show. That's it. Today, I have, I think, rather a special treat. Very recently, I discovered David Wood. I believe it was our producer, Chris Himes, that sent me a video. And to say that I was captivated would be kind of an understatement. David Wood has a story unlike any I've ever heard. And because of the story, I think whatever else David Wood says is particularly compelling. Just recently, he spoke about police violence and how a group of people, for example, Black Americans, might come to perceive cops differently than the rest of us. It was tremendously compelling. But when you hear his story, which I want to talk to him about right now, it all becomes that much more compelling. So David Wood, forgive the long winded introduction. Welcome to the program.
Hey, how's it going, Eric?
It's going swell. I want to talk to you about your story. I don't know where to begin. When you tell the story in the video where you're going through the subway, you touch on some stuff that's just unbelievable. But I even thought to myself, man, I'd love to ask him about some of the stuff he's talking about. So I don't know how long this is gonna take, and I don't care because it'll be fun to talk to you. But you, let's start at the beginning. Today, you describe yourself as an apologist for the Christian faith, but you've had just an insane background, and I want to go back. So when you tell your story, how do you typically start it?
I usually start with I think 5 years old, and that's kind of the first moment I recognized that there was something different. At first, I thought it was something different about my mom, but basically my dog died, and I was over someone's house, and my mom got a phone call, and I could tell something was wrong by my mom's reaction on the phone. But she turned to me and told me that my dog Goliath, that I'd had as long as I could remember, had been run over by a bus. And my mom turned and she had tears in her eyes, and I just remember thinking, so what, it's just a dog, why is she crying over this? And so I thought there's something wrong with my mom. And so it took me a while to figure out that other people cried over something dying as well. And just recognized over time that people have these strange reactions to things, which, I mean, even as a, you know, 6, 7, 8 year old, seeing people cry over something or someone dying was confusing. I'm sitting there thinking, what is the relationship between these, you know, this stuff leaking from your eyes and this, whatever it is, dying? I see no connection there. It doesn't make any sense. And I normally begin with that because that's, and the reason I begin with that is I'm guessing there are other people who have that same problem, but they're called psychopaths.
Well, so, listen, yeah. The part of the problem and the joy of watching your videos is that you tell insane stuff in a very matter-of-fact way. You have a great sense of humor. That's what I think makes just watching you so entertaining. You're telling stuff that is unbelievable. I mean, you were genuinely violently psychopathic. Before we get to the hammer incident, you talk about, I guess, you know, you've always been very intelligent, but you had, you know, what most people would think of as just straight up crazy ideas that you, yeah. you thought that cats were communicating with you. Mm-hmm. You thought, talk a little bit about that, because, you know, just the fact that that was you and you're you now, tell us something about that.
Yeah. So, a psychopath is someone who just doesn't form normal emotional attachments to other people. And they tend to be manipulative and they lack empathy. And so I had those issues, but also I just had delusional thoughts. Like you said, when I was young, I thought that, you know, the first time I can recall this happening was when I saw some fire ants walking in a line, and I suddenly concluded that ants were controlling the world. And the only way I could describe it when this sort of thing would happen would be like, if you've ever seen those 3D images where it just looks like some squiggles on like a painting or something like that. But if you stare at it for a while, then all of a sudden like a 3D image will emerge and you're like, wow, how did I not see that before? That's what it was like when you've come to conclude that ants are actually ruling the world. And then, you know, it goes away. And then later on, other animals are ruling the world. Cats rule the world, or dogs rule the world. And they just have tricked us human beings, and they're actually super intelligent. For all of 10th grade, I believe that I controlled the weather. That whenever something happened with the weather, that I was somehow making it happen. I don't think I said this in the video, but I would occasionally think that a song was speaking directly to me, or that a book was like written directly for me.
Hold on, David. That just, you know, if you say it the way you did just now, mm-hmm. some people are hearing it as like, oh, he was just ever so slightly more adolescent than most adolescents, because all adolescents think the song is speaking to them, wherever. But you mean literally. The author of the book was speaking to you literally.
Yeah, not that he was intending to speak to me, that somehow something like the universe itself or something like that was communicating directly to. I'll even give you an example. When I read Crime and Punishment, Raskolnikov, he commits this horrible crime and he concludes that he's the Superman, but then he's all guilt ridden. And so when I read that, I actually thought that this was somehow and it's weird to describe because I didn't believe in God. I didn't believe in anything, but I believed that it was somehow a message directly to me saying, well, this guy is falling short of this Superman status. His theory isn't wrong. He's just the wrong guy because he's emotional. Well, I'm not emotional. This is somehow directed towards me. Can't explain it because, again, I didn't believe in anything supernatural.
How old were you at that time?
17 years old.
Okay, so you're 17. You're in high school, I guess, and you're mm-hmm. reading Dostoevsky. When you talk about this, and this is one of the things when I watch the video, and I hope people listening to this or watching this now will watch these videos because they need to get every piece of this. It's too amazing. But you, you know, you describe these episodes where you genuinely believed ants were controlling the world, or where you could affect the weather with your mind, and you earnestly believed that, and yet you were sort of functioning. In other words, you're going to school. If you're reading Dostoevsky, you know, you're not in a fetal position someplace. Were you recognized as intelligent? Were you functioning? Where did you grow up, by the way?
Grew up in a West Virginia trailer park. grew up in West Virginia, which, you know, it's not all bad. You live in a trailer park, so it's like hillbilly heaven. But, you know, you're in the middle of nature. There's a mountain behind you. You grew up building forts in the woods, and there's a river on the other, you know, on the other side of you. So you go fishing and stuff. So, yeah, it was pretty cool. But yes, a lot of people thought I was lazy, but every year at the end of the school year, my teachers would scold me and they would say, Wood is the smartest kid in this class and he never uses it. He just sits around doing nothing. And so that's about how it was.
Can you say what your dad did for a living?
When I was young, he got in trouble as a drug dealer. And somehow,
hold on a second. I'm just told we're going to go to a break. Okay. Nobody's going away, so I won't tell him not to. Folks, I'm talking to David Wood. David, you said that you grew up in a trailer park in West Virginia. You were genuinely psychopathic. Did you say psychopathic? What did you say?
Yeah, psychopathic.
You would have these episodes. That's my question. Before you get into the fact that your father was dealing drugs, you describe these episodes of thinking that animals are controlling the world or you're controlling the weather with your mind. And yet it seems like that wasn't always the case. In other words, did you float in and out of this, or was it a perpetual state of believing these things?
Yeah. Normally it would be, they were episodes. So mainly if it was an animal that was looking at me like a person would, if it was a dog or a cat that was just looking into my eyes, I would think that it's like bragging somehow, haha, I control you. You don't even realize it. And so, if you caught me when I was young, I would actually be talking to an animal and saying, hey, I'm on to you, buddy, not fooling me. But it would eventually go away. And eventually, had episodes where I thought that the entire world was reading my mind, that everyone could read my mind, but I couldn't read theirs, that I was, part of some sort of experiment and so on. But it could be a couple minutes or as with, me controlling the weather, where it was actually, sort of the entire school year, but yeah, kind of things like that.
You crush your father's skull with a hammer. I want to get to that because that's part of the story that was very hard to hear and kind of amazing that you experienced this. But I want to ask you, do you today, being of sound mind, do you have any idea what it was that caused this at that time? Because I really am utterly ignorant of what would make someone psychopathic, what would make someone relate to people the way you did or not relate to people. Do you have any idea? I mean, some of it almost sounds demonic. What do you suppose it was? Do we know?
I'm not a psychiatrist, but it's generally thought that you're just born that way. So it's thought that there's a distinction between sociopaths and psychopaths, and that sociopaths are somehow made that way by their early environment, and that psychopaths are just born. But it's basically like, seems like someone, who can be born with, born blind or something like that, that it's kind of a defect. And it seems that, being a psychopath is like just a kind of defect in your brain where part of you is not functioning.
But I'm saying, like, if somebody is autistic, or somebody is, what they used to call an idiot savant, I mean, the brain is so mystifying to us, but the point is that you're no longer that way. So I want to get to that. But before I ask you about that, the question would be, somebody who is diagnosed as psychopathic, is it treatable? What do people typically do if they're born this way and they get into the medical system? Is there a way to help them?
I've seen some suggestions recently that they think they can actually, that it may be treatable, especially if they catch it, the younger they catch it, basically. But historically, it's thought there's nothing you can do about it. You can kind of control the behavior, but not the issue. In other words, you're not just magically giving someone normal emotional attachments, or you're not giving them empathy. So, yeah, it's not something that you would be sent to a mental hospital long term. Like if you were having delusional thoughts and you were out of touch with reality, it'd stick you in a mental hospital for that. But if you're a psychopath and you're doing something wrong, they send you to jail for it. It's not considered something where you're out of touch with reality. You're just wired differently.
Well, let me ask you, if somebody had, you know, met you when you were 15 years old, do you think a lot of people would have thought this guy's scary, crazy, he's going to kill people?
No. And that's kind of a difference between sociopaths and psychopaths. They both had the same label. It's antisocial personality disorder, but sociopaths tend to be hotheads. They flip out over things when something doesn't go their way. Whereas psychopaths are more cold and calculating. But basically you learn to blend in. Like I said, when you're young and you see other people reacting in a certain way, then you start mimicking other people's emotional reactions. I remember being 7 years old when another animal died in this house we were living in, and I saw that the other kids in the house all had their heads down at the table. And so by this time I realized, oh, okay, I need to act like they do. And I thought it was somehow in the angle of the head. So I'm trying to angle my head in the same way they are. And it didn't work. One of them goes, look, Dave doesn't even care. And you basically get better and better at it over time.
Yeah.
Until, you know, you know how to act sad. You know how to act in the ways that other people are reacting. You know how to keep your mouth shut when something's going on.
I think a lot of people who aren't psychopaths experience something similar, right? Like you look to people for how to behave independent of your feelings. I mean, if you're a kid and you're at a funeral, you might not know, you might not care particularly, but you know you're supposed to be quiet and somber or whatever. But of course, we're talking about something dramatically different with you. Take us to the place, if you would, because it's just so staggering to listen to in the other videos. But why did you feel that you wanted to kill your father?
It was kind of along the lines of what I was talking about with reading Dostoevsky, that I had already been thinking, because here's the main problem. When you're growing up and you don't have normal emotional reactions to things, you don't know that there's something wrong with you, that you're defective. You think that there's something wrong with everyone else and that you are somehow better than other people. So you don't think, oh, other people lack. You don't think that you lack some ability that other people have. You think that you have some new ability, the ability to not respond emotionally to things. And so you start thinking that you're better, that you're superior to everyone else. Everyone else is controlled by their emotions and you're not. And then so along those lines, and then reading Dostoevsky and thinking that I'm some sort of Superman. When I was running from the cops one night and ended up in someone's backyard and ended up trampling through someone's garden after realizing that I didn't care about their stuff. But I just got this rush of, it's weird to talk about because it's insignificant. It's someone's vegetables in the backyard. They probably never even noticed. But to me, it was getting to a backyard and starting to walk around someone's garden and then pausing and stopping and thinking, why am I being respectful towards this person's stuff when I don't care about the person or that person's stuff? And then thinking that I'd somehow been manipulated and conditioned by society to respect people's stuff when I had no reason to respect them or their stuff. Why would I care at all? And then walking through that stuff and feeling like I'd somehow been liberated from a kind of mental shackle where I'd been trained to behave in a certain way. So it kind of started with that and then just kept increasing to where I felt like I was, I don't know, pulling off like this stuff that had been attached to me over time. But the stuff that had been attached to me were like rules and stuff that were put on me by inferior beings. And so just kept doing that and eventually got to the point where like attacking my dad was like the final step in some sort of metamorphosis
Well, I mean, this makes it makes a kind of bizarre sense. But before we get to that, I just want to go back for a second. Were you consciously an atheist? Did you have a worldview worked out that where you began to think like, if there is no God, then these rules are in fact social constructs and they have no hold on me?
Yeah, absolutely. And that was from, I'm not sure exactly when, I don't recall ever believing in God, but as far as, you know, when I'm clearly acknowledging that I'm an atheist and trying to figure out what the, you know, how this works out with all these things that we're told are right and wrong, somewhere in the, you know, early teens, like 13, 14, figuring out that, you know, is basically two places that our moral values, moral laws can come from. They're either hardwired into us, in which case, well, they're not hardwired into me. I don't have those same, I don't have those same inclinations to, right, to help people to do right. So if it's just hardwired into us, well, guess what? I shouldn't have to go by your hardwiring if you're wired differently, or it's just society putting in it into us, but societies do things very differently. So you look around at the world and, you know, I mean, we can look around the world now, but I mean, you know, you can have your sister walk down the street in a place like Pakistan. She walks down the street by herself. There are places where they'll beat her to death and it'll be done by her family.
Hang on. We're going to go to a hard break. Forgive me. We'll be right back, folks, with David Wood. Mm-hmm. Hey, folks, Eric Metaxas here. The Trump campaign has a special offer just for you. The president really wants to give you a signed 2020 Make America Great Again hat. He wants to make sure the lucky winner is one of his top supporters. Be sure to enter soon because this is an opportunity you don't want to miss. The offer is only going to a select group of supporters, and you're one of them. All you have to do is text Metaxas to 88022 today for your chance to win a piece of history, a 2020 Make America Great Again hat. Again, that's Metaxas. Metaxas to 88022 to enter to win this contest and join President Trump in the fight to keep America great for four more years. This was paid for by Donald J. Trump for President Inc. Today, you have a chance to make a difference. For families in Guatemala and the other countries food for the poor serves, COVID-19 is more than just a medical crisis. For the children, the most vulnerable, it's quickly becoming a food crisis. Informal markets are shut down, curfews are in place, crops can't be planted, and parents can't even earn the few dollars a day they relied on to provide for their children. The numbers are staggering, but you can change the world for a child today. Food for the Poor's longtime partners on the ground report their warehouses are empty even as the need grows daily. Those accustomed to working and providing for the family now beg for food to save their children. Your donation to Food for the Poor will get emergency food relief into the hands of the children who need it most. Your one-time gift of $111 provides three children emergency food relief for the next 6 months. A one-time gift of $185 feeds five children for 6 months. Make your most generous gift today by calling 844-863-4673. That's 844-863-HOPE. Or you can give online at MetaxasTalk.com by clicking the red emergency food relief banner. How many children can you save? Go to MetaxasTalk.com. Hey there, folks. I'm talking to David Wood. David, your story is just unlike anything I have ever heard. It's so compelling. I just want to keep going. You know, you talk about being a psychopath, but of course, thinking in your psych, what's the word? Psychopathy? That's not a word.
That is a word.
It is? In your psychopathy, you are thinking that you're better than other people and that you don't need to be governed by any rules. You can do anything. And it seems like what you're saying is that you felt that the more violence you did or the more trouble you got into, the freer you would be, as though you're freeing yourself from the shackles, these constraints of what society calls good behavior.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so, yeah, with my dad, that was kind of, again, the final. Like, I couldn't think of something worse to do than attack my dad with a hammer, right? Like even before that, when I was thinking about bombing people or something like that, I was always thinking, well, it's easy to do that with people you don't know. It's, you know, it's something different. If you, you know, attack your own family or something like that. So I view this as kind of like, this was the final step. And after this, I was going to be what I was somehow meant to be in some weird way, which didn't make sense from the perspective of an atheist, but that's just how it is when you've got mental health issues. There, you know, you can believe, hey, I'm somehow meant to be this way and this is my destiny or something, even though you don't believe in any higher purpose to anything. And the only way I can explain is you do not see those contradictions.
So to go back before you try to kill your father and almost succeed horribly, you wanted to build bombs. So you were building bombs.
It was basic stuff. So I learned how to build pipe bombs, start off Molotov cocktails and stuff like that. And then pipe bombs. And then you realize that anything more advanced that you want to build, you have to actually study for it. So, when I started off in college, I was going to be a chemistry major so I could learn how to do this stuff. And, but I was starting my first year of college when I attacked my dad. So,
now, how did you pay for college? I mean, it sounds like, you know, I just can't imagine. Were you working someplace?
At first, no. I ended up, I hadn't paid anything. I kind of just started. I was in my first semester. So later, after I got out, I started off using with just Pell Grants to start, and then and after that, I had scholarships because.
So just amazing to me that, you know, you're this jumble of you know, genius and psychopathy, as I've learned it's pronounced. No, so you want to build bombs, you want to kill people. Did you get to do anything along those lines before the incident with your father?
No, basically, you know, pretty regular crimes and so on, but it was kind of do that first. Oh, you know, regular, like breaking into stuff, not, you know, not murdering.
Yeah. People. Why were you running from the cops that day? Like, did you have run-ins with the cops normally?
I was pretty good at evading cops, but that particular night I had broken into a store in the middle of the night and, they caught me later. I was heading down the railroad tracks and they sort of cornered me on the rail. Well, the railroad tracks went alongside the river and then there was a hill and there was a road. And so the cops were on the road and they were coming down beside me. And then they were in front of me on the railroad tracks and behind me on the railroad tracks. So the only side was the river. So I swam across the river and, the Monongahela River. Yeah.
Is that a big river?
It's a good size river. Yeah.
Crazy stuff. All right. Well, so let's get to this ugly moment. You decide, I mean, I'm just fascinated with the way your brain worked or didn't work at the time. You decide that by murdering your father, who I gather hadn't done evil to you, so that this is not like a rational response to his evil where you say, I need to kill him. It was really not coming from anywhere except the idea that you wanted to do the most wicked thing you could think of to free yourself and to sort of come out of this cocoon in which you felt trapped.
Yeah. And so, I don't know what you're allowed to say on the radio, but...
you're allowed to say anything you like. If you can't say it, we'll cut it out.
Yeah, I hit him in the head with a hammer the first time. And I didn't know what the human skull could take, but
now wait a minute. He was sleeping.
Yeah.
So you get a hammer and you go, your father's sleeping. And as he's sleeping, you're a big guy. You hit him with a hammer. I mean, I just cannot even imagine, that you actually went through with it and you hit him more than once.
Yeah, I hit him the first time, and then I was actually about to stab him so that it would look like more than one person did it when it was being investigated, and then as soon as the knife touched his stomach, he woke up, and he said, "Hey, what's up, Hotshot?"
Yeah. You had hit him in the head with a hammer.
Ball peen hammer. So not a regular small claw hammer. Like if people don't know what a ball peen hammer is, that's the one, a bigger hammer with a bigger end. And I was 235 pounds. And so, I mean, I clocked him and there was no response from him. And so
said that there was blood.
Yeah. I meant there's no response from him. That he just stayed still.
All right. And hang on. We normally don't go to a break after something like this, but we'll be right back, folks. Folks, I'm talking to David Wood. Some dark stuff in this story. David, you're describing trying to kill your father. And I'm just, you know, when I watched the video, which we will post, where you talk about all this stuff, but you didn't really make some of this clear that I'm hearing now. I mean, it's just, and I don't mean to be morbid, believe me. I'm just fascinated with what you're describing. The idea that you do such violence to your father, and that somehow insanely he doesn't die. He gets up and says, "Hey, what's going on?" or whatever. Like, I mean, can you explain that a little bit? I'm just lost.
Yeah. Well, so at first I hit him once, and it was sort of right here on the forehead.
Hard. And
yeah. Full force. So, I mean, he always, even though he survived, he had a hole there. Not, I mean, his skin was there, but there was an indentation because the skull was missing there. They didn't patch that up. So it actually knocked a hole in his skull, and he didn't move, and there's blood running down his head. And so I had no experience of killing people before, so I assumed that was enough. And so I was about to stab him in the stomach, and as soon as the knife touched his stomach, he wakes up and looks right at me and says, "Hey, what's up, Hotshot?" And it's weird because that's what he called me when I was a little kid. That's what he called me when I was like 6 years old. He called me Hotshot. He didn't call me that when I was, you know, when I was in my teens or older and so on. So, anyway, I hit him again, and then he started, he was kind of caught in the blanket that he was under, but he was trying to move when I hit him again. And I ended up, after hitting him a couple more times in the head, he sort of made a gurgling sound and just slipped back into the pillow, and I hit him again. And so altogether, I hit him probably 7 or 8 times. And
with a hammer. I mean, David, again, forgive me for being, it sounds like I'm being morbid, but I mean, it's just, it's utterly mind-blowing to hear you describe this, and then to learn that, in fact, he survived. You said he had brain damage, of mm-hmm. course. I mean, I'm amazed that he survived at all. Mm-hmm. What year was this?
This was 1994.
So what happened to you after this?
That was actually early Thanksgiving morning of 1994. This was in Virginia. And after that, I went out, got into my truck, and drove to West Virginia, where the rest of my family was gathering for Thanksgiving. And it was there. I got there, and that's when they told me that my dad was actually alive and in the hospital. They had taken him to a hospital, and the hospital said he'll die here. So they took him to another place where they had sort of a world champion neurosurgeon to kind of patch his head back together. But yep, went up there, and my mom took me to a mental hospital.
And you went to the mental hospital. You didn't resist?
No. My original plan was, I'm going to do that, and then I'm going to go, and I'm going to say that happened when I wasn't there, and make it look like it was multiple people. And so it's going to make it look like it wasn't me. And, that was the original plan. And then got to West Virginia, and then I find out that my dad is alive. So gosh, I assume that he's down there telling them what happened and so on. Whereas later I found out he had no recollection, but I assume he was down there saying, here's what happened. And so my plan going into the mental hospital was, okay, my mom will bring me in there, and I'll say, I don't recall what happened. No idea. And instead they kept asking me questions and giving me tests. And then later I got the paperwork, and they say, this guy's a psychopath. And so,
So this begins your journey into the jail system, into the mental health world. How many years did you spend in prison?
I had a 10 year sentence, and mainly because my dad didn't want, he's saying he doesn't want me incarcerated for this. So they could have given me more time, but they ended up giving me 10 years. And so under the old law, if you stayed out of trouble while you were incarcerated, this is no longer the law, but under the old law, for every 30 days you spent without getting in trouble, you had an additional 30 days of what's called good time, meaning they could take that from you later on if you got in trouble. But as long as you stayed out of trouble on a 10-year sentence, you'd end up serving a little over 5 years. So I served a little over 5 years in jail and prison.
And they didn't have any fear that you would do this again? Why wouldn't they assume that you would do something like this again?
Oh, yeah, they most certainly did. So they were constantly asking me questions, like, because by that time when I'm locked up and getting closer to getting out, they're sitting me down and they're saying, hey, you know, what are you going to do when you get out? And by that time I was a Christian. So I would tell them, I'm not going to do anything. I'm going to go to church and I'm going to go to school and all this stuff. And they're like, yeah, but what if you stop believing in God? What then? And I couldn't lie. So I don't know what I'm going to do if I stopped believing in God. I don't know what I would do.
Well, yeah, you just jumped to this idea that you became a Christian. I mean, that story in and of itself, I want to hear that story because, you know, I've heard part of it in your other videos, but you're very smart. You're very crazy. You're in jail now. When you first get there, what do you think is going to happen? What do you think? Are you thinking about that? I mean, it's hard to really process someone like you because, you know, you're this amalgam of different things. What happened? I guess you said you start arguing with a roommate who's a Christian, or with a roommate, cellmate.
Yeah, well, at first when I got locked up, I just thought it was part of this ongoing process that now, you know, I'm going to go through jail and prison, and I'm going to somehow come out again in some new way or something like that. But yeah, I was in actually a dorm with a guy named Randy, and Randy was kind of different from everyone else. He sat up on his Bible. I mean, he sat up on his bunk reading his Bible all day, and wasn't doing any of the same stuff the rest of us were. I found out after a while that he'd turned himself in on 21 felonies. And so just one day I walked up to Randy and I said, hey, you know why you're reading the Bible? Reading the Bible because you're born in the United States. If you've been born anywhere else, you believe in something else. If you've been born in China, you'd be a Buddhist. If you've been born in India, you'd be a Hindu. If you've been born in Saudi Arabia, you'd be a Muslim. But people like you believe whatever you're told to believe. And,
okay, hold and on. Don't say his response until we come back, because this is classic. We'll be right back. Okay, David Wood, you just described that you're talking to your cellmate, your bunkmate, and you're just hostile toward what he, you know, you say he's a Christian just because he's been told to be a Christian, because in America, that's what they tell you. And what happens?
Yeah, so I kind of had the same idea of Christianity that I had about, you know, morality in general, that these are just things people tell you and you accept them because you don't know how to think for yourself. And if you do think for yourself, it's a bunch of total nonsense. And, Randy actually was the first Christian I'd ever met who put up a fight and would actually argue with me. And that was weird. And whatever we were talking about, I would just give him my views of, you know, Jesus and the Bible and so on. And it's stuff that no one had ever challenged before, because I had never studied this stuff. I'd never studied, you know, the historical Jesus or philosophical arguments for the existence of God. I just sort of came to conclusions over time without seriously studying. And this guy, all of a sudden, the annoying thing was he would just question everything I would say. He'd say, where'd you get that from? You know, where'd you come up with that? And I would have to think, and well, it wasn't by, you know, seriously studying. Yeah, where did I come up with that? And so we just kept getting into this series of arguments. And It was kind of messed up. So because I started looking for other ways to beat him, so I would go around telling people he's gay and things like that, and said some nasty things about his sister to him. And
I mean, you were just sawed off to win, to beat this guy somehow. He challenged you in a way you'd never been challenged. He's obviously no dummy. You're no dummy. So it's a little complicated how this process unfolds.
Yeah, well, I mean, I thought I was humanity 2.0. You know, I'm the smartest, most advanced person in the world.
You still thought that. Okay, so.
Yeah. Yeah, and so, you know, I'm sitting here and can't win an argument against a Christian who's dumb enough to turn himself in for 21 felonies. What, like, why? You know, what's going on here? So there's just kind of, you know, there's a kind of hostility there. And so, you know, had to defeat him in other ways. And one of the ways was we got into this fasting battle where he would fast a certain number of days, where he was just doing it because in jail you can fast long term, and he was taking that seriously as like a Christian discipline, whereas I was just trying to outlast him. And so the first time I ever fasted in my life, I went 10 days on nothing but water, and it was just to beat this Christian.
Just competitive fasting.
Yeah. Yeah,
you don't find that funny, like all these years later?
Yes, I do. It's absolutely ridiculous.
it's hilarious. Like, yeah. You were just sought off, competitive, and here you have a Christian doing this, and you're like, okay, I'm going to beat you on this. Just, I guess, just to beat him on anything, it seems like. I don't know.
Yeah, and that's actually doing that multiple times, because I kept doing it. However long he would go, I would go a couple days longer, and then I was. He eventually went 40 days. He fasted 40 days, and so I declared that I was going 42. He told me it's because, you know, Jesus had done it, and so I said I was doing four. I was going to go 42, and I was on day 11 when they concluded that my mental health problems were causing me to somehow starve myself to death. And so, yeah, they put me in a camera cell. So they sucked me in a cell where I have a camera pointed at me in case I wanted to harm myself. So it's just, looking back, you're right. It's kind of amusing now. They think I'm trying to kill myself. I'm just trying to beat a Christian. I'm just trying to beat this guy.
Well, we're done with hour one, but I am really thrilled that I get to keep talking to you. I think your story is going to touch a lot of people. Folks, I hope you can continue listening. David, thank you, and we'll just continue on the other side of this break.
All right.
We are raising money for Food for the Poor this month. People often say, you know, God has blessed me. I want to give back. Food for the Poor is an organization that we have vetted. We work with them. They feed the poorest of the poor in third world countries right now because of COVID. Folks in Haiti and Guatemala and countries like that are struggling even more than they were before. If you go to MetaxasTalk.com, you can see everything. And by the way, there is a phone number. I'm going to give you the phone number. Folks, write this down. We really need your help. The phone number is 844-863-HOPE, 844-863-HOPE. Please dial it right now, 844-863-HOPE, 844-863-HOPE. Thank you.